KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today I continue our run of discussions with regard to patent law. For those of you who have been listening to Hearsay Culture with any regularity, early on in the show I had the pleasure of chatting with my colleague David Olson, who is a patent law scholar and the other resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society. And just a few weeks ago, I had the pleasure of having on Mark Lemley, Stanford Law School professor and one of the foremost scholars in intellectual property law and a patent law expert as well. I now have on another patent law expert, but one coming from a different background. I have on today one of the co-authors of the book Innovation and Its Discontent, subtitle How Our Broken Patent System is Endangering Innovation and Progress and What to Do About It. So the subtitle, of course, is quite direct, and so I don't really have to explain where the book is coming from, other than to say that Josh Lerner, a professor at the Harvard Business School and one of the co-authors of the book, along with Adam Jaffe, who is not with us today, is taking a look at this issue from the perspective of an economist and a business person generally, and taking a look at it from the perspective of what the system is doing to commerce in particular, and looking at it from a perspective not only of law, but generally of a system that is in need of significant repair. And Innovation and Its Discontents is a very challenging as well as controversial book, one that came out a few years ago and that has gotten quite a bit of attention in the years since it came out. And so even though the book actually came out in 2004, the book is still very much not only relevant but also essential to considering all of the viewpoints with respect to the patent system and deciding ultimately where you think we should go. So I'm very excited to have Josh on today to discuss the book. He is the Jacob H. Siff Professor of Investment Banking at Harvard Business School, and he has a joint appointment in the Finance and Entrepreneurial Management units. He's also written other books, which we won't chat about much today, but include the Money of Invention. So I'm very excited to have Josh on today to talk about these issues. I mean, patent law is really at the front and center right now of intellectual property law, especially as the Supreme Court has rendered several decisions in the last year that go to the heart of the patent law system, both what is patentable and what relief can be sought and how far patent goes. So we're going to touch on all of these issues and get the perspective of a very unique and a very challenging author, Professor Josh Lerner of Harvard Business School. So we'll take a short music break, and when we come back, we will talk to Professor Lerner. The weirdness of Bob Dylan and the band there with a heavy and a bottle of bread, and before that, the band's classic, When I Paint My Masterpiece. If I've done my job properly, at the other end of the line is Josh Lerner. Josh, are you there?
I sure am. Thank you.
Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture, and I should say on air, thank you for your patience in scheduling this interview, as I had to reschedule it several times as I adjust to the wonderful world, and it is truly wonderful, of having a very, very young baby. So thank you for your patience and in being here today.
Oh, the pleasure's mine.
And by the way, for clarity, I will refer to the book as your book, but, you know, for the record, of course, your co-author is Adam Jaffe. But we'll refer to it that way for ease of the listeners. Let's jump right in with, the name, which itself is, very gripping. Why did you title the book that way, and how did you come to this topic?
Well, it's fair to say that I've been somebody who looked at intellectual property for quite some time. Really, my other interest, as you alluded to earlier in the introduction, is the venture capital world, and particularly when I was doing a lot of my work in my thesis, I did it through a variety of circumstances, largely focusing on venture capital investment in the biotechnology industry. And essentially, you can't spend a long time looking at the biotech industry without realizing the importance of patents. And can't spend a long time talking to people about patents without realizing that there's some significant issues and problems there. So over the course of the 1990s, I'd done a series of studies looking at how firms behave strategically using patents and in some cases exploiting the patent system to advance their goals. And it made me realize that there was a real opportunity, given how esoteric some of the issues were, and also just given how much of the discussion about patent policy had been done by lawyers for lawyers. It was a real opportunity to do a more accessible book that was really geared towards a business rather than a legal perspective. And that's really what motivated us.
And of course, it's not any great stretch to say that patent law is something that all businesses, even if they're not directly patenting themselves, should be aware of. And I'm curious, given your perspective as a non-lawyer looking at the law of patents, how challenging that was.
Well, I mean, clearly it's an area where there were really two sets of challenges, one of which is, as you allude to, that the law itself is quite complex, and particularly when you get into, you know, things like the doctrine of equivalence or the reverse doctrine of equivalence. You know, for writing for the typical layman, eyes are going to glaze over, and there is clearly a lot of legal complexity, and it was important, we thought it was quite important to get things right as we wrote the book. At the same time, we also wanted to bring in some of the economic perspectives. And while there's a lot of theory of intellectual property, a lot of that theory is quite complex in its own right, with a lot of mathematics and, you know, just in many cases what seem like very esoteric sets of assumptions and conclusions. So as a result, it really was an exercise of threading the needle, which is in a way to give a sense of the complexity and the issues that were there, without necessarily drowning the reader in either, you know, in either the legal or the mathematical complexity of the economic theory.
From the perspective of someone who went to law school and who works in the law school, it's always interesting to see how the law is discussed outside the realm of those that are immersed in the law itself. And I'm curious, given how long you've been looking at intellectual property law, and particularly patent law, since your book came out, I'd be interested in knowing if patent law is being discussed in business schools generally today, and in fact, is it more front and center as it is in law schools, given its increasing prominence not only in the courts but also in discussion of business models in the technological world?
It's a great question, and I think the answer is that it's getting more attention, but only relatively slowly. You know, traditionally, it wasn't really front and center in terms of the business school curriculum. There might have been a little bit of discussion of intellectual property in the strategy course, but that was about it. But over the last few years, we've seen courses at a number of schools being introduced along these lines. We, in fact, at Harvard Business School, will be introducing a course for executives next year on the strategic use of intellectual property, you know, which is more geared not for the MBAs, but for more senior people in the industry. But, you know, there's been a variety of efforts like that, but it's certainly got a long ways to go till it has the kind of ubiquity and importance that it probably deserves, given the role that it plays in so many high technology industries today.
Along those lines, do you find, again, as a non-lawyer looking at these issues, that your thoughts and ideas and suggestions with respect to the law are being weighed or observed and analyzed by the lawyers?
Well, I think that it's fair to say that there's been a confluence of things that have led to more discussion and awareness of the impact of the intellectual property system. And clearly, part of it has been due to a number of writings, and I think I would put ours in that category, as well as the Federal Trade Commission report of a couple years back and the National Academy of Sciences study, which have given, you know, more visibility to these issues. We've also seen a few very high-profile cases, and I think that clearly the Research in Motion case with the Blackberries, you know, had a kind of visibility to it in terms of creating an awareness that there was a big issue going on here, and that something, you know, that something seemed to be quite wrong with the system. We've also had a new Chief Justice of the Supreme Court who seems to be taking a particular interest in some of these cases, and that's reflected as well in the docket the Supreme Court has had. And finally, I think it's fair to say that a number of large corporations, and I would put IBM and Microsoft as examples, have decided that, you know, sort of just laying back and letting the system, you know, sort of evolve as it does is too costly and too problematic, and have thrown their considerable resources behind patent reform, which clearly always helps in terms of getting real visibility for the issue.
The that last point kind of segues into getting a little bit into the book, and as I mentioned in the introduction, you take a lot of very strong positions, some of which that are quite controversial, and I want to explore some of those and see how you respond to some of the concerns and criticisms that are raised. But before we get to that, it would certainly behoove me and would benefit the listeners to cut to the chase in terms of the book. And perhaps you could describe your major proposed reforms of the patent system.
Well, what we emphasize very much is in terms of addressing, first of all, the process by which patents are granted. And the argument we make is that essentially whatever one does about the litigation process, if you just simply have large numbers of invalid patents being granted, one is likely to have a major problem. And in particular, it seems that the way to address this is to essentially not to do what the typical response has been in the patent office over the past decade, which is to say, well, we'll free up another hour per patent for the examiners to look at these things, but instead to focus on the tapping the knowledge that's out there in the form of whether in the form of individuals who are working in research positions at competing firms, whether in the form of academics or graduate students, whether in the form of other interested industry observers, and to basically move away from the idea that the patent examiner themselves is responsible for coming up with all the prior art that can conceivably be found out there. Because I think that particularly in areas of emerging technologies, it's just an impossible challenge to expect a patent examiner in 12 or 14 or 18 or 20 hours to be able to come up with all the relevant prior art.
Right. And so, on that point, I do want to interrupt you quickly for benefit of the listeners that aren't familiar. Of course, when we're talking about patents, we're talking about that exclusive limited monopoly that exists when one invents something and seeks to commercialize it. Prior art has a very specific meaning in the patent system. If you could describe it briefly for the benefit of the listeners who aren't familiar, that would be great, and then continue with the reforms.
Well, essentially, the idea of being granted a patent is that there's several tests which are done in terms of whether something qualifies for a patent. And in particular, the notion that's typically used is that somebody who is skilled in the art or somebody who is familiar with what's out there beforehand, but not necessarily somebody with an extraordinary set of skills or insights, would they basically see the invention as basically being obvious, or would they see it as being a real inventive step forward? Mm-hmm. So essentially, one of the important tests that's done in terms of reviewing patents is to look at what's out there beforehand. And it could be in the form of another patent, but it could be in the form of an article in a scientific journal, even of a posting of a working paper on a website. That will all be stuff, or just even stuff that's being done by firms in, for instance, computer programs. All that stuff should be considered by the patent office in making their evaluation of whether the invention truly is a novel one that deserves patent protection.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. With that background on your reforms.
So essentially, what we propose is having a gradated series of reviews where there would be a possibility of people, even before the patent is issued, shortly after the patent is published by the patent office, that people would have the opportunity to contribute prior art, to contribute material that should be relevant for the patent office to consider before they even make the decision as to whether to issue the patent. Similarly, even after the patent issues, before there's any kind of resolution or litigation taking place, again, there should be an opportunity for people to be able to challenge or oppose the patents that have just issued, and again, be able to sort of go in a relatively quick low-cost environment and present to the patent office reasons why that patent should not grant. So essentially, the idea is not that the patent office itself should, you know, try to do it all itself, or not that it should spend the same amount of time on every patent, but rather it should let the market or let people tell it when there are applications that are problematic and basically take advantage of the information being generated to go ahead and use that to do a more thorough patent review. So in some sense, it's a little bit like taking some of the ideas of the open source community and applying it into the patent arena.
The re-examining point is interesting, and so we're clear, you're not talking about re-examination in the sense that you have to go to court for patent litigation.
No.
So I guess at that point is a particular interest. Maybe you could describe in a little more detail how that would be implemented and what you think its effect would be on the various bad patents that, quote-unquote, that we'll talk about shortly.
Well, essentially, if you look at, for instance, the experience in Europe, where there has been a robust opposition system, as it's called, you know, for many years, you'll see that there's essentially far more patents being challenged there shortly after issue than in the United States. And that in a significant number of cases, the patents are either dramatically narrowed or else voided outright by the European Patent Office. So it seems that sort of having an opportunity to do this process, to undertake this kind of review process, where essentially people could contribute knowledge, where the patent examiners could look at and consider what the challenge and the information that's being brought to bear, could essentially knock out a significant number of patents, or at least claims of patents, prior to ever having to engage in the costly process of litigation.
Is, from the perspective of, again, one teaching in a business school, litigation costs generally are always, obviously, they're not a good thing. And, of course, as a litigator, I know that, as a previously being a full-time litigator, I know that whenever pretty much I spoke to a client, they were always assuming bad news because very few people really like litigation. And I'm curious, with respect to patent reform, how much you think the cost of patent litigation requires that the patent system be reconsidered?
Well, I mean, certainly you raise a good point, which is that, you know, the litigating a patent, particularly defending a patent, is a tremendously expensive process. And I think there are certainly things that can be done to address the litigation process as well, but I think the most important thing is just simply to avoid getting bad patents to issue in the first place through the steps that I outlined a little earlier. But certainly once patents issue, I think that one of the most egregious areas, which seems to be, you know, an initial starting place in terms of reform, would be in terms of addressing the concerns about the use of juries. And in particular, if you look back in the 1920s and 1930s, it was exceedingly rare to have a patent case that was heard before a jury.
Mm-hmm.
Today, it's ubiquitous. And in certainly the statistical evidence gathered by people such as Kimberly Moore, you know, suggests that juries are much more inclined to vote, you know, almost blindly with the patent holders, and that when we look at the the other indicators in terms of patent cases, often it's been instances where they've sort of sided with, for instance, domestic firms against foreign firms in a very disproportionate kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that you can make a compelling case that, you know, just as we've, sort of allowed judges to focus in on making determinations about patent claims in terms of, you know, essentially through what are called Markman hearings, or these preliminary hearings which determine the scope of the patents under consideration in litigation. So, too, it would make sense for judges to have the responsibility of determining issues around infringement.
The along those lines, to delve into some of the points you made in your book, I do want to ask you, relatively early on in the book, you offer a pretty scathing analysis of the patent bar as being self-interested and ultimately not interested in innovation. And I want you to contextualize that analysis, and then I want to ask you really whether you feel that as indeed, again, your book having been written a few years ago in 2004, as more and more academics wear the of counsel hat, where they're keeping their finger in the mix, as it were, in the practice of patent litigation and patent prosecution, and indeed, you know, Mark Lemley is a perfect example of that.
Right.
And indeed, as more and more people recognize that needless litigation is ensuing. And finally, the fact that this, as we've just been discussing, the fact that the Supreme Court has a half a dozen cases on its docket this past year dealing with patent law. Do you think that your conclusions with respect to the patent bar are still as strong as you believe they were then?
Well, I think there has been some degree of positive change. Though I must say, you know, the process has been quite slow in coming. But certainly there have been, you know, a few areas where you can look at and quite a fair amount of room for optimism. And I think certainly one of these areas has to do with the role of legal academics in terms of pushing this. I think in many ways, at many law schools, historically, patent law had a bit of a status which was similar to that of entrepreneurship at business schools, which was that essentially the subject was in many cases left to practitioners to teach on a part-time basis, and in many instances, you know, those people were busy, you know, sort of doing stuff in the real world, and didn't have time to publish, or if they did publish, intended to publish in, you know, specialty field journals, which were quite insular in many respects.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what's happened in terms of both fields, both the intellectual property in law schools as well as entrepreneurship in the business schools, is that in the last decade, these things have become so big in terms of the amount of student interest, in terms of the, you know, the economic importance that they have, et cetera, that the sort of state of benign neglect that sort of characterized them traditionally in the academy has been needed to be addressed. Mm-hmm. And I think that in both fields you see increasing representation of, you know, more traditional academics who are publishing in, you know, major discipline-wide journals, and, you know, sort of bringing a fresh perspective to many of these issues.
Do you view the patent bar as an entrenched group that has very strong interests that really ultimately are contrary to what would be good public policy?
Well, I mean, I think that you certainly can point to certain corners of it and say that that's indeed the case, because you know, as in everything, you know, there's sort of different perspectives, and
mm-hmm.
you can't really paint with, you know, sort of incredibly broad strokes.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to the issue of cross-licensing, which is, of course, a major issue, and indeed, it's especially from a business perspective, it's one of the real benefits of having a patent. For the benefit of the listeners, after describing what cross-licensing is, I'm curious to get your thoughts on one of the points that you were making, which is the relationship between cross-licensing and technological innovation.
Well, I think that you can certainly argue that one of the real strengths of the patent system is that it does allow firms to contract on intellectual property. In other words, if we just had trade secrets, or we just had people just basically protected their ideas by keeping them secret, then essentially people's ability to really enter into contracts and negotiate and enforce those contracts, saying, "I'll tell you my secret, but you know, we can't sign a contract until you agree not to tell it to anyone else and promise to pay me a royalty," you can imagine how that would get very difficult in terms of the negotiating process. Once people have formal intellectual property rights, such as patents, it becomes easier in many cases to license intellectual property. And as a result, you see many examples of firms either taking patents and licensing them to a wide number of firms, or else you see firms joining together in patent pools where you essentially have a number of firms forming sharing patents with each other, or you just see bilateral cross-licensing agreements where essentially you have two firms who essentially share intellectual property with each other, perhaps in exchange for a royalty or perhaps on a royalty-free basis. In some respects, this can be very positive because it basically can allow situations where one firm has a patent that's relevant across an industry, and it can allow the other firms in the industry to get access to intellectual property. But there are also examples where cross-licensing can be more harmful. And in particular, you can end up in situations where essentially you get established companies within the industry cross-licensing to each other, but it is essentially virtually impossible for a new firm which doesn't have any wampum, which doesn't have any kind of patents that they can exchange with the other firms in the with other firms in the industry, then may be in a situation where they're facing extraordinary fees for breaking into that industry, and essentially the cross licensing agreements can deter entry.
The entry into the market and information failures, both from the administrative side and from the public side, are something that I want to get into after the music break, which we're going to take now. You're listening to KZSU, Stanford University, and Hearsay Culture. Dave Levine in discussion with Professor Josh Lerner of Harvard Business School on his book, Innovation and Its Discontents. We are going to take a short music break, and then we will come back and to continue the discussion.
There are many who would consider it a crime to do what I've just done, which is fade out Zeppelin in the middle of a song. And indeed, I do have qualms about cutting songs short on the show. On the other hand, it is an interview show, and the music breaks are meant as just that, breaks from the conversation. That, of course, was Led Zeppelin and What Is and What Should Never Be off of the BBC live recordings, which came out a few years ago. Before we return with Professor Lerner, I do want to do what I always do at the bottom of the hour, which is to ask you for money for KZSU. Where I am recording the show today, actually, March 21st, the same day that the show's going to be aired. If you enjoy what you're listening to, or even if you're not enjoying it, but I hope you are, but you want to support something else on KZSU, KZSU is a public, non-commercial radio station that relies on donations from listeners to continue putting forth its broadcasting and its programming. If you are interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have two options. You can go to kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU, or alternatively, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless, I do hope you continue to enjoy the show and do keep listening. So we're back with Josh Lerner. And Josh, let's turn to before we get to some of the operations of the Patent Trademark Office. I do want to touch on an interesting angle that you took in your book, which is to look at the history of the patent system going back to England, and ask you in a broad sense whether you feel that we today in 2007 are reverting to the 19th century English patent system in any respect. If we are, I'd be curious to know where you think we are, and if not, perhaps you can describe for the listener in very broad tones what that system was and why we aren't.
Well, I think that it's fair to say that there has been an ebb and flow in terms of patent protection, where we've essentially seen protection in some periods being extremely strong, and as a result, there being patents being very powerful weapons against rivals, and in other periods where there seems to have been very much of an anti-patent mentality, which has led to a weakening of the system. And I think that when we sort of look over recent history, we would sort of point to the period really from 1982 with the creation of the Court of Appeals of the Federal Circuit to today as being a very strong period. We would then sort of look for the period from the 1930s to 1960s to be an extremely weak period. We'd look at another period of very strong patent protection. Before that, there was quite a backlash that had led to a weakening of patent protection. And before that, again, patents were quite strong. So we've seen this sort of ebb and flow in terms of patent protection, not just in the United States, but truly across the world. That is sort of swept across across time.
Mm-hmm. Is the as we look at the system as it exists today, we see one of the classic problems that has existed in virtually every government known to man, which is a lack of resources. And one of the points that you make in your book is looking at both the funding for the patent and trademark
right.
office, but also its very operations. And you touched on that in discussing your proposed solutions. The information failure here, of course, is one of the information simply not getting to the Patent and Trademark Office, and you discuss it at great length in the book, various patents that had been issued that had the prior art that we discussed earlier been made known or been aware, been simply, had it been information that the examiners had, they may not have issued the patent.
Right.
I'm curious to know whether you feel that the problem in terms of getting that information to the examiners is a function of underfunding or a lack of understanding or just a lack of knowledge with respect to these industries, especially when we're dealing with things like software and biotechnology and these very heavily scientific realms, or whether you think there's some other group of factors, including these, which contribute to this information failure and consequently the issuance of these perhaps unnecessary patents.
Well, it's an interesting question, and I don't think there's one answer. There's probably several different answers. Certainly the lack of resources in the patent office doesn't help, right, in the sense that, you know, we get, you know, various communications from patent examiners from time to time, and certainly a number of them have highlighted stories where people were essentially forced to buy publications out of their own pocket for which were sort of critical in terms of evaluating patents, simply because the office didn't have the budget to purchase these periodicals.
Hmm.
Secondly, you know, it's clear that in many cases the examiners are looking for stuff and just don't know how to look for it. So to use one example, there's been essentially a series of patents granted on for an individual who has essentially gotten patents on extremely long-lived or infinitely-lived options, and where he used a particular terminology to refer to these options that was different from that which was in the literature, where basically there had been a series of articles by people who subsequently won Nobel Prizes, like Bob Merton and Paul Samuelson, in the 1960s and 1970s about these infinitely-lived options. But because the patent applicant used a different set of phrases to describe it, when the patent examiner put those phrases into the patent office's search engine, he was unable to come up with any relevant prior art.
Hmm.
So I think that certainly the lack of resources and the lack of familiarity are problems, but it's clear that this is not something which is just confined to, you know, newfangled cutting-edge areas. And in fact, when you think about, you know, the case which is pending before the Supreme Court right now that, you know, should be decided in the next couple weeks, the KSR case,
mm-hmm.
which deals with the question of what constitutes an obvious invention, the technology there is about as low-tech as it gets, namely something to adjust the height of a brake pedal, which mm-hmm. has probably been around, a technology that's been around since the birth of the internal combustion engine.
Right.
So it seems like this is not just a problem of one or two new technology areas, but it's a more systematic difficulty in the business.
You may have an opinion on this, you may not, but I'll throw it out there. from the perspective of a lawyer, traditionally, one who was going into the world of patent law was usually well advised, what is perhaps still well advised, to have a scientific background.
Right.
Having said that, more and more you do see people who are patent litigators, perhaps not prosecutors, but litigators who don't have a scientific background. Again, we're focusing on the legal profession, so maybe you don't have a strong opinion on this or might need more, but I'll ask you from the perspective of one teaching in the business world, whether you see that as a factor in any of the issues that are arising with respect to the issuance of patents.
Well, I think it is clear that the importance of patents is being realized much more widely within organizations. So, for instance, when you think about something like the standard-setting process, if you had looked 10 or 15 years ago at who was attending representing large corporations' standard-setting meetings, you would see that it was overwhelmingly dominated by engineers. Certainly today, when you look at the same groups of people from the same companies attending the same standard-setting bodies, you'd see a much greater mix of people. So you'd see much larger representation of lawyers, of MBAs and business development roles, also attending these meetings alongside the technologists. You know, certainly many people who are, who have a technical background or are familiar with the workings of these organizations over a long time argue that the sort of arrival of these people has, led to, making the negotiating process more challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But you can certainly understand why firms would feel that, standards are quite, are essentially too important to be left to the engineers in some sense and are quite relevant in terms of firms' strategic objectives as well.
Mm-hmm. The issue kind of raises a very broad question, which I also want to ask you directly, which is, do you dispute the notion that patents and the patent system is a necessary element to inducing innovation and invention in the technological sector? In other words, do you see that there is redundancy in the intellectual property system such that patent law isn't as important as it once was? Or conversely, do you view patent law as the sine qua non of what is necessary to spur innovation in the tech sector?
Well, I think it's clear that patents play a very important role in this. That, in many instances, the inventions or innovations take a lot of money to develop, and that essentially companies would be unwilling to make those investments were it not for the assurance that they would be able to profit from these things. That essentially companies' willingness to just simply do innovation out of the goodness of their hearts is going to be by definition very limited because they need to answer to shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
And while there are some alternatives that are out there, such as, for instance, governments offering prizes, the track record there has been somewhat mixed, not the least because essentially governments often don't have a terribly great idea of, what inventions are really the important stuff that needs to be done and which are sort of interesting, nice things, but which are really essentially, relatively irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result, the beauty of the patent protection is because essentially it provides a monopoly for the inventor. If it's a small idea that's trivial, you will essentially have a monopoly for something that's trivial, and you essentially won't make very much money from it. While if you have something that's an important idea, in theory you'll have a much broader patent, which will allow one to make a great deal of profits from that. The problem comes in a situation which has characterized the U.S. in recent years, where one's essentially had individuals who have essentially not innovated or done very modest innovations,
mm-hmm.
nonetheless getting quite broad patent protection.
Which gets me to another a particular pet peeve of mine. My scholarship has focused and continues to focus on trade secrecy, and particularly the secrecy element of it. I have very serious concerns about the use of trade secrecy in what would otherwise be public projects, like the building of a voting machine, for example. And that's an area I focused on heavily, and that I continue to focus on. So I've had the view, and I want to get your reaction to it, that on balance, patent law is more democratic in the small d sense because it allows for transparency. I'm curious to know, curious to get your reaction to that, but also to ask you about the issue of vagueness in the applications. That being that the description of the invention or the process or what have you, is by virtue of the fact that people generally want to reveal as little as is possible in order to get the benefit that they seek, quite vague. And indeed the standards allow for increasingly vague descriptions of what is sought to be patented. Do you see, the efforts to say as little as possible, in a patent application as a major problem both in the law and also for businesses?
Well, I think that certainly when you look at what a patent is supposed to entail, or what the bargain in terms of a patent is supposed to entail, there's essentially a trade-off. And the trade-off is that you get this monopoly protection, but as a result, you disclose the idea and the way in which one can implement that idea. And certainly when you look at a variety of technology areas, it seems you're absolutely right. There's been a fair amount of gaming to say how much is the littlest we need to disclose here in order to get this protection.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly you can reasonably characterize those instances as ones where companies are trying to essentially have their cake and eat it too, in the sense that they're really trying to get all the benefits associated with patent protection with none of the responsibilities that go with it.
Do you see businesses themselves having any interest at all in having greater transparency in the patent system or the intellectual property system in general?
I think it's a good question. I mean, I think that certainly you can see some you see a fair amount of interest in terms of the process of avoiding bad patents and having efforts to try to get better review out there. But you know, that's been the major focus of the corporate efforts that I've seen up to this date.
Mm-hmm. Do you see, in terms of the business perspective, the businesses' perspectives generally, what's your sense of what they consider to be the biggest problem with the patent system itself?
Well, I would think that, you know, for many of them, it's essentially the prevalence of essentially trolls or individuals who are getting dubious patents and then litigating them.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, in many cases, it essentially is, you know, it has a bit of a flavor of a shakedown game, in the sense that these individuals are, you know, getting patents, you know, with, you know, sort of relatively dubious quality, but essentially threatening to enjoin the people that they litigate against. And in many instances, the companies have to do a calculation saying, we can either spend several million dollars on litigation, you know, go in front of a jury and run danger of basically being enjoined from, you know, some of the critical technology that is behind our business,
mm-hmm.
or we can just simply pay a couple million dollars and make this dispute go away. And in many instances, it is, you know, far easier to just simply pay the money and make it go away than to, you know, try to fight it out.
Let's, in the remaining few minutes that we have, I do want to focus a little bit on software patentability, which is one of the most front and center and certainly most controversial areas in patent law right now. Where do you think we're headed on that issue? And in your, along those lines, the two-part question, where are we headed? But secondly, you point out in the book that indeed software was being created. In other words, there was inducement to create software before the patentability of software was relatively established by court decisions. But is there an argument against the patentability of software if we can solve the issue of prior art? In other words, the fact that yet again we have a situation where patents are being issued on inventions that simply are not new. They don't have the novelty or perhaps some degree, the non-obviousness, but certainly the novelty that would necessitate or allow for the issuance of a patent. Do you see that issue as being conjoined with the issue of prior art?
Well, I think that certainly there's a couple of things going on here, and it's certainly a controversial and complicated issue. But certainly it's fair to say that many of the software patents that have issued have been exceedingly poor, and that one of the big problems has been that essentially there is a lot of prior art, that people have written a lot of software over the last few decades, but relatively modest amount of patented prior art. And that much of the prior art that's out there has been very hard for the patent office to hunt down and evaluate. So as a result, there have been a whole series of patents granted on software that really is not really an innovation, but which the office was unable to determine that fact. That being said, as I highlighted before, I think the issue is not so much one of, is confined to one or two technologies, but is a much more systemic or general issue, and that the sort of prevalence of bad software patents is a symptom of a more general problem of the patent office, rather than being something about software in its own... software uniquely.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result, what I would like to see in terms of addressing this is not, getting rid of patents on software, but rather in terms of addressing the sort of more fundamental quality issues which manifest themselves most visibly in areas like software.
As the closing question, as we only have a couple of minutes, I guess I want to ask you, your book having come out in 2004 and all the changes that we've been chatting about, do you see any of your proposed reforms as coming to fruition, either partially or further, or are we moving further away, in your opinion, from addressing the issues as you proposed in your book?
Now, so there have been a few developments that have been quite positive. And I guess I would highlight some of the reform legislation that's been proposed in Congress, much of which has some very reasonable ideas in it, including, facilitating people's ability to oppose patents.
Is there a particular bill that you're thinking of?
Yeah, I'm going to have to sort of punt on the exact number of what it is in the current congressional, in the current Congress, because basically there was hearings held last Congress on the bill, and these have been reintroduced on both the House and Senate side.
Okay.
One also sees a variety of private sector initiatives that are which are being done, in some cases independently, in some cases in conjunction with the Patent Office. So, for instance, IBM has been trying to do an effort where they're essentially going to be trying to harness the power of the Internet to, pump out patent applications as soon as they get published 18 months after being filed. And then try to create a sort of minimally refereed process where people can contribute prior art, which will then be packaged up and sent to the patent office.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a variety of creative things being done. Well, the Congress has not moved rapidly in terms of addressing these issues. There seems to be greater awareness of these things, and there is promise that these things are going to be seriously addressed in the years to come.
With respect to anything in the intellectual property system where people have concerns, I would say that yours is among the most positive and optimistic outlook on where things are headed, and perhaps it's somewhat unusual for me to have a discussion in this area and be able to end it on a quasi-positive note. So I will actually take advantage of that, since we're coming up on, we are at the end of the interview, and stop there, and certainly invite you back to discuss these developments as time progresses, because an hour is, as always, just too short to delve in as much as we'd like. And otherwise, to thank you, Josh, for coming on and discussing your book, Innovation and Its Discontents, here on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you so much. Very much enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank Professor Josh Lerner of Harvard Business School for being on today, discussing his very controversial and challenging book, Innovation and Its Discontents, How Our Broken Patent System is endangering innovation and progress and what to do about it. And I do commend him on his clarity and directness in getting right to the point, right on the dust jacket, of the book. So, I'm a big fan of that level of candor. So I commend, Josh and his co-author, Adam Jaffe, for being that direct. The show is being recorded on March 21st, 2007. And so you are hearing the show the day that it was recorded. And you can look forward to several interesting guests coming up. I'm very excited with everyone that I've scheduled. Coming up next week will be Professor Terry Fisher from Harvard Law School, who will be on discussing his book Promises to Keep, which is a very balanced but very forceful analysis of the entertainment industry and both its flaws and potentially benefits of changing or not changing the copyright and royalty system that exists today. And then following Professor Fisher will be Cass Sunstein, a professor of law at the University of Chicago, who will be on discussing his book Infotopia. As always, you can hear this show in a number of venues. If you're listening today live on KZSU, that is probably the best option because you get the benefit, as it were, of the music that I've selected. I do not replicate the music for the podcast, so you can listen on KZSU-FM. But for those of you listening by podcast, you have a number of options. First is to go to the iTunes webpage for the Center for Internet and Society, which is simply by typing in the search engine for podcast, Center for Internet and Society. Alternatively, you can go to the Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu and subscribe to the podcast feed there. Or lastly, you can go to hearsayculture.com, the website that I've set up and dedicated to the show, and you can pick up the shows there. I also, on that blog, will do my best to link to as much information as I can with respect to the guests and the topics discussed. So I do encourage you to check any or all of those venues. With the iTunes page and the CyberLaw page, I might add, you can also get not only Hearsay Culture, but all of the other speakers and guests that come through for the Monday Speaker Series, which Lauren Gelman, my colleague, who's the Associate Director, sets up, and she brings in great guests, so you can look for those as well. Thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture and for hopefully enjoying and learning from it. As always, I do encourage you to offer me any feedback or suggestions with regard to the show, and you can email me directly at dave@hearsayculture.com. That's dave@hearsayculture.com. Otherwise, I thank you for listening and encourage you to stay tuned to KZSU for Mike and Baptism of Solitude. Thanks again and have a great day.